Yes, welcoming you to this Sunday morning session. Dear listeners, obviously, as the sounds particularly that you heard there coming through just before we actually started, from, you know, for the past 12 minutes, particularly the songs of Jamiroquai with the song Automaton, are getting you into a little bit of some West African sort of like sounds, specifically that coming through from the artist. The song's name is actually Zozo, but the artist's particular name itself, and that's if I find the right folder here in front of me, in terms of just, yes, Dobe Nahore, in terms of the song Zozo. The album is also by the same name, Zozo. And finally, you heard the songs of the Spanish rapper himself, Si Dangana, with the song specifically, Tu. Let me get my Spanish right here. Tú me dejaste de querer. Yeah. Don't ask me what it means, guys. It's completely in a different language. And primarily, it ultimately also gives you a little bit of some diversity. Now, on this particular notion, dear listeners, I welcome you to my Sunday morning take, which obviously takes us from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m., specifically where we will be in each other's company. And we'll also be taking a look particularly at this morning's particular subject matter, as we did miss each other a little bit last week, specifically, just to cite, you know, that brief break there between us in terms of engagement. And as we always take a look on my Sunday morning take, we take a look at the aspects of everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and a little bit of everything else in between, in order to understand specifically where certain things actually come from, how they came to be, and how they actually impact us today in a modern societal context. Now, as we take a look specifically into this morning's particular subject matter, that's if you have seen this social media poster for this morning's particular session. Yes. I'm not also doing, you know, my particular part in letting you guys know early enough, because there are a bunch of you listeners who actually, you know, you guys do wake up a little bit early. Obviously thanking you for that particular aspect, but once again also, you know, complimenting, or sort of like complimenting the aspect in terms of letting you know what's going to start from 5 a.m. Now, we get into the realm specifically of history in this morning's particular discussion, because it is actually squarely positioned on the notion in terms of where Namibia finds itself, or what happened in Namibia during the First World War. Now, not much has been taught about this particular subject matter in Namibia's history, Namibia's particular historic relevance during the First World War. Also, not much is being spoken about in the broader Namibian context in terms of how those came to be, you know, what were these particular aspects. Up and until last week, not this week that passed, the week before, where I found myself obviously, you know, if I can call it an exploratory expedition in terms of uncovering, you know, Namibia's particular cultural and heritage gems and jewels across much of central and northern Namibia, or central, north, and northern Namibia, just to outline it in that scenario. And obviously, as, you know, going from spot to spot to spot to place to place to place, you stumble upon a few things that you never knew actually should have been contained in history books, even on school and so forth and so forth and so forth. Well, this particular morning session here on my Sunday morning take gets us into one such particular rabbit hole. Not that the term rabbit hole, which in its entirety actually speaks about, you know, going down by a potential lost cause. But this particular rabbit hole is one based upon a unexplored aspect of Namibian history. Now, you have to understand, guys, that the engagement that I had specifically, or me and the other particular, you know, media practitioners that we had, for example, with the governor of Ochotonjupa region, that's obviously Governor Kamusep, and then also bumping into the tour guide, that is, installed by the National Heritage Council. Well, there are like one or two or three tour guides technically there at Lake Oshikoto. And then the tour guide that we obviously had that helped us in terms of understanding many things and guiding us through our particular expedition, not this week, the week before. All of them spoke about history, aspects of history that I have not seen anywhere in the history books on school that I grew up with, nor the history after school, because I'm a history buff. I love history. I love the subject of history. I love it. There's just no way that you can come and tell me that history is probably the most boring subject ever. I love history. I really do. I really do. And every day, my love specifically for this subject matter just grows every day. Every day. Because when we got to Lake Oshikoto, that's now coming back. I mean, obviously now coming back here, you know, Windhoek's direction specifically. And that was the Friday afternoon. We stop at Lake Oshikoto. We talk to the gentleman who's the tour guide there. He gives us a little particular rundown, small history lesson. Explains to us how this particular lake, it's not a man-made lake. If you did not know, dear listeners, Lake Oshikoto is actually a sinkhole. The one particular feature that I kept talking about specifically on other notions here on Eagle FM, that is potentially the one feature you don't want to see happening in Namibia, obviously because of, you know, rapid and uncontrolled borehole exploration and drilling, is the creation of sinkholes. Lake Oshikoto is a sinkhole. The tour guide literally explained it to us. And he literally said, this is a sinkhole. So if you ever want to know the dangers of uncontrolled borehole drilling, you know, into the aquifer, because understanding the size of underground water in Namibia is so vast that the depth of the Lake Oshikoto has not been confirmed, because the divers could only go 250 meters and they had to come back up. Now, if you're going to ask me, why did they only have to, could they only go 250 meters deep? Primarily, dear listeners, it's because of water pressure. The deeper a human goes, the more water pressure they will encounter. 250 meters was primarily the safest, what do they call it? The safest range for them to be able to explore. This is the same particular aquifer that connects you to Dragon's Breath, which is on the other side of Grootfontein, which accesses the same aquifer. The particular aquifer that I wrote about in the photo feature about the abandoned mining complex at the location known as Abenap. The mine's name was Abenap Mine. It obviously shares the same name specifically like, the farm and the lodge that is right next to it. It's on the farm and the lodge is right next to it. And obviously the particular abandoned mine features as a specific, tourist attraction, facility, but it actually is an integral part of Namibia's mining history. So it plays a more significant role. What you find at that particular mining facility is that the water that started flooding the lower chambers of the mine comes from the same aquifer. It comes from the same aquifer. when you start looking at the connected particular history of Namibia's, not just mining history, the wartime history, the First World War history that took place here in Namibia, as well as also the other particular developments in terms of Namibia's first railroad history itself, you sit with probably the most unexplored, well-documented in other places history of your country. No, really, guys. Really. Well, it's documented, but in other places of your country. About events, developments, as well as also situations that took place. Why? Because the tour guide at Lake Oshakoto, the tour guide and the tour guide that was with us, that spoke to us about the Fort Namatuni's particular significance in just the First World War period, as well as also in terms of German Southwest Africa administration and the Awambo kings, you know, the relations that existed between these particular two groups in a Namibian context, specifically that it was also very fragile in many cases. I say very fragile because we were shown the monument on both sides of the pitched battles that were fought. And it actually brings us into a scope that the governor of Otjotjontjupa himself, Governor Kamusep, shared with us in terms of us, the journalists specifically, because he cited many particular, you know, plans in terms of, establishing heritage sites across his own particular region. Now, one of them is actually a particular site where he has, that's now the governor, Governor Kamusep, has specific, if I can call it a relation to, specifically because he shared with us also that he grew up and stayed in Otavi. And for many people who don't know, is technically that Otavi was also known as the particular place where the German colonial forces actually surrendered to the South Africans. But the South Africans under the British flag, because by that time they were known as the Union of South Africa. And there is so much literature, so much data, so much information about the South African campaign, or as they call it, the British campaign of Southwest Africa, because it obviously was conducted by the very famous, for those of you that loved buying at a specific shop by the same name here in Windhoek, specifically if you were a student from NUST or someone living there in Windhoek West, the very famous Southwest African campaign conducted during the First World War by the very famous South African statesman, General Louis Botha. That's where the shop got its name, just so that you guys know. It got it from there. So, in many scenarios, dear listeners, we sit with a history that we don't actually know much about, because in many cases it starts from the start of the League of Nations. I'm also citing to you where my particular history also started from. And then there's a whole bunch of gray areas that sometimes you just leap from one context into the next particular time period or frame. Now, the reason why as towards we're looking at this particular scenario is the campaign itself was a important one that actually saw a lot of pitched battles being fought. When I say pitched battles, there were a lot of particular engagements and clashes between the Germans and much of the local particular, you know, groups that were present in Namibia, which are obviously still present. It's also that much of this particular time frame flows in after the period of genocide in Namibia specifically, because it helped establish a certain particular if you look at it in terms of a time sequence, the, you know, the sequence and everything. So from 1904 to 1908, we obviously know about that particular dark chapter in Namibia's history. But after 1908 and all that, you get a sense in terms of much of the particular developments that obviously, firstly, helped the local colonial presence of, you know, the German colonial forces establish various fortifications, distribution networks, the likes. And then obviously the First World War kicks off. And that's where we find ourselves in terms of after they've established many particular things, we start off with the events that obviously led from there. Now, before we continue, dear listeners, we're really going to take a short musical break. After the musical break, we're going to come back and we're going to head in full steam into the particular talking, the particular subject matter of this morning's particular engagement here on my Sunday morning take on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And we'll be back right after this.
It hit like a train. Got nothing to say. Everything hurts, and I know love leads to pain. But memories serve our sweetest refrain. The waves came tumbling down as you float away. Reaching for you to tell me how my life goes on with you gone. I suppose I sink like a stone if you leave me now. Oh, the storms will roll, easy come, hard go.
From the sounds specifically of Ed Sheeran with Life Goes On. And obviously that brings us up to about 5:32 this morning. And if you've just woken up, good morning. Welcome. You're listening obviously to your favorite number, your favorite radio station, that obviously being Eagle FM, where we obviously bring you the, you know, the insights as well as also the insides of various particular developments and subject matters, as well as also, giving you the opportunity of, tuning in and listening to something new every day. Now, obviously, since you're here with me on my Sunday morning take, which will last us from 5 to 7 a.m., and I do hope you've got a cup of coffee in your proximity, we continue with where we left off, specifically with taking a look at the First World War campaign that occurred here in Namibia itself. Now, I've got to start from the particular starting point that Governor Kamusep shared with us media specifically 2 weeks back, or actually a week and a half back. And we'll start from the Battle of Otavi, specifically in that scenario, before we branch out into the rest of the Southwest African campaign, as it is known historically. Now, the Battle of Otavi was fought between the military forces of the Union of South Africa and the German Southwest Africa on 1 July of 1915. And this was the final battle of the Southwest African campaign of World War I. Now, as you all would know, the First World War technically lasted from 1914 to 1918. From the recent particular discussions and engagements that we had here, specifically the one based upon the universal human rights discussion that technically saw Australia and Japan not be on the same side around the same fire because of the particular stance that the Australian Prime Minister took versus the stance that the position that the Japanese had in terms of laying down the first particular, it would have been the first recognized human rights, universal human rights declaration itself. And obviously that was one of the particular first instances that actually created the first particular flaws within the League of Nations, which was the organization that came into effect after the First World War ended. And they were busy negotiating in 1919, if you guys don't know, in Paris, and this was known as the Paris Peace Agreement. Now, the battle which was fought between the Otavi Mountain and the Otavi Fountain, the word fountain, was actually a delaying action that was led by the German Major Hermann Ritter. Now, Ritter's forces intended to buy the main German force at Tombe several days of time so as that they could harden their positions in that particular scenario. But in the end, the South African general, Louis Botha's forces were able to rout Ritter's troops, leading to an overall breakdown in the German lines that brought the campaign to an end. Now, by mid-1915, the South African advance in German Southwest Africa had actually gained specific and considerable ground, and as well as also efforts at negotiating a ceasefire had actually failed. Now, rather than seek a decisive battle, the German commander at the time that was present in Namibia, Viktor Franke, had decided to resort to keeping his army as intact as possible so as to maintain a German claim to the territory after the end of the war. So if you guys don't specifically understand what this translates to, is that primarily the aspect was obviously one of realizing that trying to get support and further particular assistance from, let's say, from Germany in Europe was a little bit of a Herculean task and a Herculean request, primarily because Germany itself was not known for having well-established naval supply routes. And then obviously if you look at how far on a map, how far Namibia is from Germany at the time, you would realize that it would just be an impossible task. The second aspect that obviously comes to light in what you just heard regarding that, you know, Franca tried to keep the forces as intact as possible, meaning he tried to keep the presence, he tried to keep the army that he had here in Namibia as under control and as in close proximity of command and everything as possible, primarily to try and still stake out a claim that the particular, you know, the presence of any particular German colonial rule was still to be achieved in the event specifically that a peace treaty was signed back in Europe and that everything goes well and, you know, is amicable or, you know, returns to a friendly enough state after hostilities. But here was the problem, dear listeners. You had the Portuguese to the north in Angola, and that's what I heard specifically on the particular engagements with the tour guides. The Portuguese were to the north in Angola. You had the British on four sides, which was Zambia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, and South Africa. The South African guys were technically known as South Africans because they were known as the Union of South Africa, but you had to consider them as British. The downsides was that you didn't see the British literally utilize four entry points into Namibia. The British just had the South Africans move from the south into Namibia, and the Portuguese pushed from the north into Namibia. Now, you're going to ask me why the Portuguese were involved in this particular conflict. And I will share it a little bit later in the show as well, is that the Portuguese, technically since the Napoleonic period of European conflict, were, protectorate. They were, not military allies, but they had some sort of a protective agreement and various kinds of protective agreements with the British. Well, first and foremost is that the Portuguese were not the colonial power that they were back when they discovered, you know, when they went and established Brazil as one of their largest particular colonial possessions, nor were the Portuguese in the same frame, for example, of, you know, the early days of exploration and, you know, sort of like being bold themselves in international affairs, like they used to be specifically everything prior to 1700. So here, obviously, you saw what the dilemma was for the German commander at the time, Viktor Franke, because they would be pushed in, they would be advanced upon from two directions. And specifically, this is everything after the period of Namibia's genocide chapter, as well as also the particular period after various engagements with other particular local groups or ethnicities. The engagement that took place between the Germans and the Ovambo King, King Nehale, was prior to the First World War. So if you guys need to understand those chapters, those conflict chapters happened prior to the First World War's period. Now, the background aspect obviously saw us getting back to the Otavi battle, or the Battle of Otavi. Now, Franca obviously had huge issues, because rather than resort to guerrilla warfare or attempt to break out of German Southwest Africa, Franca decided to retreat along the railway and build up defenses around Tombe. Now, with the South African army leader, Louis Botha, rapidly approaching, Franca decided to leave a delaying force under his second-in-command, Major Herman Ritter, at Otavi Fontein. Now, the delaying force was tasked with holding up Botha for as long as possible so that the main force at Tombe could concentrate its forces and solidify its defenses there. Botha began his advance on 18 June, learning from intercepted communications that the Germans were actually retreating up the railway, but would not retreat farther than number 20. Botha split his 13,000 troops into four columns, with one on each flank, and two under his personal command, driving up the railway. Now, with a swift advance, the South Africans began to surround the German positions, and Botha's central columns managed to reach Otavi by 1 July. Now, what is central and important to understand here, dear listeners, is technically that the railway line led to Grootfontein, if you don't know. The railway line led to Grootfontein, but what I can understand is that also the railway line also connected to Otavi. So it also split at a specific point, and then it connected Otavi in that scenario. Reason being is that specifically the engagement that we had with the governor of the Hotchodontjupa region is that there is some significant particular, I almost used the word artifacts, but historic, you know, installations there that are unique, that provides an aspect of, you can call it heritage, because military history in many cases is also heritage, whether it be colonial or not, but it helps to describe something and it helps to, you know, helps to formulate understanding of developments and events that obviously took place in a specific time frame. The time frame that obviously stems from this has been that the delaying force was actually tasked with holding up Botha for as long as possible so that the main force at Tombe could get their position in order. Now, Botha began his advance on 18 June, as mentioned, and obviously he reached Otavi by 1 July. The Germans thought that Botha's advance would actually be hampered by a lack of water and the rough terrain, because they actually also thought, you know, if, and you would find this a lot, guys, if you ever go and read into all the particular documentation stuff that exists of how the Europeans, you know, explored here in Namibia and in other parts of Africa, especially here in Namibia, is that they struggled to understand the vast distances. Let me latch that into this particular conversation specifically, because the tour guide at Lake Oshikoto explained to us that Lake Oshikoto was, I don't want to use the word discovered, because it already existed, and local communities or local groups that obviously lived before Namibia's particular colonization in and around Lake Oshikoto knew about Lake Oshikoto. Lake Oshikoto was labeled as a specific lake, put that in inverted commas, because two particular explorers in the 1800s thought they had reached Botswana. The reason was they were looking for a specific lake in Botswana, and as they obviously, you know, ventured and walked along and explored, they came across Lake Oshikoto, and then they thought they were in Botswana, and then they thought they had reached a specific lake that they wanted to, you know, that they were trying to reach. They did not know about Lake Oshikoto's existence before then. And so they thought they technically were in Botswana, but they needed to have traveled another couple of 200 kilometers eastwards, and they would have been in Botswana. They would have just reached the border. They still had to get the additional kilometers in Botswana to obviously say where they were. Now, the Germans obviously thought that South Africans did not know about Namibia's harsh terrain and all that particular, you know, aspects in terms of traversing and being able to move across South African terrain, which was actually one of the biggest fallacies and untruths that you could ever discover, because the South Africans were used to the terrain that you would find in South Africa in many cases, which is very similar to the terrain in Namibia. So too also in Botswana. There's a lot of terrain that is very similar to Namibian terrain. Now, the Germans were actually very ill prepared for the looming South African attack that would obviously, you know, take place. Now, at his disposal, Louis Botha had 3,500 cavalry compared to Ritter's 1,000 infantry and 10 machine guns. Remember, the Battle of Otavi was technically Ritter holding up Botha. Now, although heavily outnumbered, Ritter's forces did have the advantage of the high ground, as the territory that they were defending was quite mountainous. Despite this particular advantage, Ritter feared that his force would become surrounded, and he spread his forces out to lengthen his line of defense. When the battle actually kicked off, Ritter's line of defense was so long, his flanks were unable to support each other. That, combined with the lack of his forces to man such a wide perimeter adequately, caused his left flank to falter when the South African forces advanced upon it. Now, fearful his lines would break further, Ritter then pulled back to the hills of Otavi Fontein and to Otavi Mountain. Despite the fact that these new positions held the high ground, the Germans had not prepared any fortifications there. With no artillery and no solid defensive positions, the German forces easily broke into a general retreat when pressed by Botha's troops. By 1 p.m. that afternoon, the battle had actually ended, with Ritter pulling back to positions near Gaup and leaving Botha with a clear path to the main German body at Zombe. Now, remember, all of this obviously took place on 1 July of 1915. Now, Eugen Mansfeld, who was present at the battle as a reserve lieutenant in the German forces, laid the blame for the German defeat squarely on Franke. Because remember, Franke was in Zombe, Ritter was trying to defend in Otavi, and obviously Mansfeld was part of Ritter's particular, defensive position. Now, Mansfeld stated that Ritter had occupied an excellent defensive position at Otavi Fontein, but that on the morning of 28 June, 3 days before 1 July, Franke had arrived with his staff officer and ordered a redisposition of Ritter's forces south of the original position, separating Ritter's three artillery batteries and leaving the companies of troops widely dispersed in no logical order. Mansfeld suggested that if the Germans had kept to Ritter's original plan, the South African forces, who were unable to transport water by railway, would have been forced to retreat to the nearest water station, with severe losses to their horses as a result. The particular aftermath that followed after the Battle of Otavi Fontein was that Botha's victory was swift, with obviously the South African advance being delayed only by a day and suffering only 4 dead and 7 wounded. The Germans had fled without putting up any committed defense. Ritter's forces had fled largely intact, with only 3 dead, 8 wounded and 20 captured. Although a delay of just 2 days by Ritter would have sufficed, Ritter's early withdrawal allowed Franke's unprepared forces to become nearly encircled. The German forces retreated to the farm of Korab, which is also another particularly historic site, where on 5 July of 1915, they set up a defensive position around the farmhouse and the reservoir, which is obviously a water reservoir. With no means of escaping further up the rail line and a general lack of will to pursue any further course of action, Franke had little choice but to surrender his forces to Botha on 9 July of 1915, effectively ending all major German resistance in Southwest Africa. Now, on that particular note, with the listeners, we're going to step into another musical break. After that, we're going to come back and head into the overall Southwest African campaign in its own right, in terms of looking at the major particular developments and obviously the talking points that stemmed from there. We'll be back.
Sycamore in the summer, barren leaves. Swing you pushing our daughter underneath. Flowers bloom in the garden, swaying breeze. Just imagine a world where we could.
running wild. Worried about my lover and I'm worried about a child. And part of me was always in denial. It's gonna take a little while. In the story, love and love out. Be our glory. In the story, love and love out. Be our glory. Sycamore bringing shade from. Nothing more than a water smoking gun. What a puzzle is this to be in love, to be planting your roots then. You better sit. Brace yourself, something's about to hit. It's gonna take a little while. In our story, love and love out. We are glorious. In our story, love and love out. We are. In the storm.
Right there with the sound specifically of Take That with the song Mindful of Madness. Before that, you had a little bit of the song of Television by the group Empire of the Sun. And before that, a little bit of some more Ed Sheeran with the song Sycamore, which specifically sounds obviously like an expectant father waiting outside for, well, his partner and newborn baby to, you know, be safe after, obviously, you know, the particular procedure of childbirth having taken place. Now, leading us into the second half, where as we have just crossed over the, what you call it, the midway point of this morning's My Sunday Morning Take, which will now last us up until 7 a.m., which will be the last hour session. We take a look specifically at the broader campaign itself in terms of as it is known, the Southwest Africa campaign, which forms part of the West African campaign. part of the African theater of World War One. I know, guys. I had to go get through all that particular words. The Southwest African campaign specifically was the conquest and the occupation of German Southwest Africa by the forces from the Union of South Africa acting on behalf of the British Imperial Government at the beginning of the First World War. Now, here's where things get very interesting, dear listeners, in terms of understanding who were on the sides, because what I did not hear in terms of the engagements, obviously from the various tour guides as we, you know, a week and a half back, and we're looking at the various historic, cultural, and various other particular aspects in terms of how cultural tourism or dimension, a further dimension of Namibia's tourism can be unlocked and is lying dormant for so long, is when you had to look at the aspects in terms of technically the defense of German Southwest Africa from the Portuguese and the British forces was on the side of the belligerents, if you now need to understand things. I did not know that the Kwanyama King, Mandume Ndemafayo, was technically on the side of the Germans and the one of the known, they call it here the Boer revolts or the Boer republics. So if you guys did not know, South Africa technically had something like two republics. Not the one that we now know of. I'm talking about the ones specifically of, you know, the aspects as the British were obviously trying to push out the Dutch-speaking settlers out of the Western Cape, and there was various aspects, obviously, since the British took over the Western Cape, and, you know, various events obviously happened. In that scenario, there were many branch-out settlements that obviously took place. One of the earliest particular known republics was the Orange Free State. It was known as the one of the first republics. There was another one, because the one that I see here in front of me, the one specifically in my literature, is known as it's one of the republics. So it's not to say that the Germans were completely alone in the Namibian context in terms of defending their colonial possession, which is Namibia, because they themselves were trying to play a role of subverting the Union of South Africa itself by supporting one of the known, they call it here the Boer republics in South Africa, against the British. So obviously you start seeing how during a wartime period, you know, various kinds of alliances are drawn up, commitments are made in terms of assisting each other, and, you know, various kinds of actions actually start translating. In the scenario as well, the Kwanyama King himself, Mandume Ndemafayo, was also on the side technically of the Germans in that scenario. Because remember, as I explained to you before the break, before the musical break, the midway point, you had the, what's the guy's name? You had the Portuguese in Angola, and the British were on four sides around Namibia, around the Germans. But before we actually continue, dear listeners, we're quickly going to come back. We're quickly heading into a short musical break. We'll be right back after this.
Let's take our time.
coming back there from the very brief, very quick. It obviously takes us into the aspect in understanding, as I outlined, who the belligerents were, meaning the belligerents being the participants to the battle on the, obviously, the German side and their particular sort of like, if I can call it, alliances. On the side, obviously, I already identified that the Portuguese and the British were on one side, the German colonial forces, alongside one of the South African republics, which was known as one of the known South African particular Boer republics, as they were identified back then, and the Kwanyama King, Mandume Ndefayo, and his particular, you know, role alongside the, if I can call it, the defenders in that scenario. Now, this particular subject matter, dear listeners, obviously takes a look in terms of the broader campaign, as in the how things commenced, because the broader campaign in the African theater of World War One, which is known as the West African campaign itself, actually lasted from 15 September to 9 July 1915. Less than a year, 9 months, 3 weeks and 3 days. That's how long this particular campaign was. The South Africans and the Portuguese showed up with a combined force of close to 80,000. Actually, this is 80,000. It technically is 80,000. The defending forces were 3,000 Schutztruppe, 7,000 German militia and settlers, and 12,000 Boer commandos that obviously came through from South Africa. The scenario from this obviously indicates to you just, you know, and if you had to look at, because there's no indication of how many Awambo, combatants, you know, were present in terms of their size, but the known wounded or the known casualties that were suffered were 25 killed and 100 wounded. And in many cases, you know, the Germans technically, they dealt a lot of damage from the numbers, the losses and casualties that I can cite here and that I'm looking at. The downside is, they obviously did not have the necessary, if I could call it, reinforcements and necessary manpower to stave off literally 80,000 soldiers. Or 80,000 allied advances into Namibia. I mean, the 12,000 commandos that they could get from the South Africa, from the South African, you know, Africa, from the South African Republic was not sufficient enough. Because if you don't know what that technique was, these were guys that were literally skirmishers. They were not, fully, what you call it, well-resourced, well-supplied army units. They were skirmishers. If you don't know what a skirmisher is, a difference between a skirmisher, they technically are still soldiers, but a skirmisher is someone that doesn't fight a pitched battle. It's guerrilla warfare that they fight with you. They have no interest. Their biggest strength is not actively being in a fully-fledged pitched fight against you. A skirmisher does good. In many cases, practices guerrilla tactics. Now, the outbreak of hostilities, obviously, in Europe in August of 1914 had been anticipated, and the government officials of South Africa were well aware of the significance of their common border with the German colony, which was at that stage occupied by...
Super bargains await you at USave, where you pay for the product and not the brand. Pay only 139.99 Namibian dollars for selected Lovis premium disposable nappies, 36.99 for 1 kilo Mama's High Foam hand washing powder, 750 milliliters Sunlight dishwashing liquid for only 32.99 Namibian dollars, and palm olive shampoo and conditioner for 34.99 Namibian dollars each. USave, I save, we all save at USave.
So coming back from the quick ad break right there, dear listeners, and obviously you are here on my Sunday Morning Take on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM, welcome, good morning, and obviously we are into the second half of this morning's particular program. Now, getting back where we left off just before the ad break was that the South Africans knew of the border between Namibia and South Africa at that time, in terms of, you know, the potential sort of like, if you can call it like the overflow or the fallout from European, from the European context in terms of the conflict there, in falling into the various particular territories across the world between the various colonial powers. Now, the prime minister at the time was Louis Botha. And yes, Louis Botha was also a soldier. He was also a general. The Prime Minister of the Union of South Africa at that time was Louis Botha, and Louis Botha actually informed London that South Africa could defend itself and that the imperial garrison might depart for France when the British government asked Botha whether his forces could invade German Southwest Africa. The reply was yes. Now, the South African troops that were mobilized along the border between the two countries under the command of the General Henry Lukin and the Lieutenant General Mani Maritz early in September of 1914 were obviously, you know, setting up their positions and getting ready for the possible push into Namibia. Now, shortly afterwards, another force occupied the port of Lüderitz. So the South Africans obviously said, you know, let's take over the port of Lüderitz and set up a particular beachhead. The news about the start of the First World War reached German Southwest Africa on 2 August 1914 via a radio telegraphy. Now, the information was then transmitted from the Nauen station via a relay station in Kamina and Lome in Togo to the radio station in Windhoek. Then steps in the first particular development that obviously takes place, but this takes place in the South African context, not in the Namibian context, meaning it is where the German commanders in Namibia actually helped or encouraged a certain particular action to take place in South Africa. So what took place specifically? Now, remember the one lieutenant colonel that I mentioned, Mani Maritz, who was one of the South African commanders that was stationed on the Namibia-South Africa border, just before the particular conflict. Mani's other name was also Gerrit. Not Gerard, Gerrit. Now, he was also a participant in the Herero-Nama genocide and later on a leading participant in the pro-German Maritz Rebellion in 1914. So what happened? The first particular Boer revolt kicked off in this particular period, just, you know, as the First World War is now heating up in this chapter of the First World War in an African context, specifically in Southern Africa. Now, there was, at that time, considerable sympathy among the population, that let me call it the Dutch South Africans, of South Africa for the German cause in terms of, you know, being present here in Namibia. Only 12 years had passed since the end of the Second Boer War. If you don't know it, it was known as the Anglo-Boer Wars, specifically fought in South Africa. There were two of them, one at the start of the century, 1900, and then there was a second one, in which Germany had actually offered the two Boer republics unofficial support in their war with the British Empire. So you obviously can see what the Europeans love to do with each other. They love subverting each other's particular presences, you know, and undermining each other's particular roles and presences across the continent in Africa and also across the world in various other parts of the world. The Lieutenant Colonel Mani Maritz, heading a command of forces on the border of German Southwest Africa, declared specifically, this is an excerpt from one of his particular writings, that the former South African Republic and the Orange Free State, as well as the Cape Province and Natal, are proclaimed free from British control and independent, and that every, obviously, the settler inhabitants of the mentioned areas of whatever nationality are hereby called upon to take their weapons in their hands and realize the long-cherished ideal of a free and independent South Africa. Now, this is obviously in opposition to Louis Botha, who was based in Cape Town as the Prime Minister at the time. So Maritz and several other high-ranking officers rapidly gathered forces with a total of about 12,000 rebels in the Transvaal and in the Orange Free State area, ready to fight for the cause in what became known as the Boer Revolt, also sometimes referred to as the Maritz Rebellion. Now the government declared martial law on 14 October, that's now the South African government, of Louis Botha, in 1914. And the forces loyal to the government under the command of the generals Louis Botha and Jan Smuts, because the two of these guys, they technically were like, Smuts was the guy that went to the Paris Peace Conference, if you guys, you know, just to resuscitate your memories about that. Smuts was the guy negotiating at the Paris Peace Conference in after the First World War, after the whole conflict. He was the guy that was also playing as a particular mediator between the Australians and the Japanese. So these two South African generals proceeded to destroy the rebellion itself. Maritz was defeated on 24 October in 1914 itself and took refuge with the Germans. The rebellion was actually suppressed by early February of 1915. The leading rebels at the time received terms of imprisonment of 6 and 7 years and heavy fines. 2 years later on, they were released from prison as Botha recognized the value of reconciliation. You then flow into the German and South African fully fledged conflict itself. Now, a first attempt to invade German Southwest Africa from the south failed at the Battle of Sandfontein, which obviously took place in September of 1914. Now, this was close to the border with the Cape Colony, where on 26 September 1914, German colonial forces defeated the Union Defense Force, although the surviving UDF troops were left free to return to South Africa. To disrupt South African plans to invade German Southwest Africa again, the Germans invaded South Africa and the Battle of Kakamas, which is actually one of the places where my dad technically grew up in. Kakamas is in the North Cape of South Africa, so if you drive over the river, you'll find Kakamas is one of the places there. And the Battle of Kakamas took place over the fords at Kakamas, specifically. And on 4 February 1915, for control of two fords over the Orange River. Now, the South Africans prevented the Germans from gaining control of the fords and crossing the river. By February of 1915... with the home front secure, the South Africans were ready to invade again. So they pushed the Germans back across the river. That's not the Orange River. And obviously now preparations are now getting well underway to start everything off. Now Botha, as a senior and experienced military commander, took command of the invasion with Smuts commanding the southern forces while he led the northern forces. Now Botha arrived at the German colonial town of Swakopmund on the coast on 11 February. To take direct command on the northern contingent and continued to build up his invasion force at Walvis Bay, which was at that stage a South African enclave about halfway along the coast of German Southwest Africa. If you guys don't know, Walvis Bay technically up until 1993 was still South African territory, and it was obviously handed over officially at the end of 1993. The reason why I know is specifically because, my mother worked as part of the particular Home Affairs officials at that stage that had to go and register and transfer so many residents of Walvis Bay over, give them Namibian citizenship, all that whole transfer, all that particular process had to take place back then. And I think it was like a 3-month period, if my memory serves me right. That specifically they had to do this, that the Ministry of Home Affairs had to do this particular transference exercise. Now, in March, getting back now to 1915, obviously, in March, Botha then advanced from Swakopmund along the Swakop Valley with its railway line and captured Oshimbingwe. He captured Karibab. He captured Friedrichsfelde, Wilhelmstal, and Okahania, reaching the capital of Windhoek on 5 May 1915. Now, the Germans offered terms under which they would surrender, but Botha actually refused these terms. On 12 May, of 1915, Botha then declared martial law, and having cut the colony in half, that's now literally Namibia, he cut it in half in terms of occupation, divided his forces into four contingents under Kumbrits, Lukin, the other particular general, Mani Botha, not Mani Maritz. Remember, Maritz was a rebel. And another general by the name of Meiburg. Now, Brits went north to Otjivrongo, Ochu, and the Atoshapan, which cut off German forces in the interior from the coastal regions of the Kunene region and from Kaukofeld. Remember, Kaukofeld was also one of the earlier names before independence that you could name part of the Kunene region. The other three columns then fanned out into the northeast, so they headed northeastwards. So we're now talking that they're now approaching from Otavi to Grootfontein northeastwards. Lukin went all along the railway line running from Swakopmund to Tsumeb. The other two columns advanced on Lukin's right flank. Meiburg went to Otavi Junction and Mani Botha to Tsumeb and the line's terminus. Now, the men who commanded these particular columns, having fought in Boer commandos, moved very rapidly. As I mentioned to you guys, remember from the first half of the show where the defending colonel, Hermann Ritter, the German defending colonel at Otavi, at the Battle of Otavi, because Otavi was literally the place where the German Southwest African control over Namibia technically ended in September of, no, on in July of 1915, was that Ritter assumed that the South Africans would struggle with the harsh Namibian terrain. But the South Africans were well adapted. This is because if they've had their combats, they know how to move, they've been in South Africa for 200 years at that stage. They knew how the terrain looked like. They just had to learn a new part or a new extension of this terrain in terms of movement, adjustment, and understanding where the water points were. So, the German forces specifically in the northwest made a stand at the Battle of Otavi on 1 July, but were beaten and surrendered at Korup on 9 July of 1915. Smuts then landed with another South African force at the naval bay of Lüderitz. Having secured the town, Smuts then advanced inland, capturing Kietmanshoop on 20 May. Here he met two columns that had advanced over the border from South Africa, and one from the coastal town of Port Nolloth, and the other from Kimberley itself. Smuts then advanced northwards along the railway line to Beersheba, and after two days of fighting, captured Gibeon on 26 May. The Germans in the south were forced to retreat northwards towards their capital and towards Botha's forces, because Botha was already in the fort. Botha was now moving from Swakop or from Walvis heading inland, and Smuts was moving from Lüderitz heading inland. So you can see this sort of like double pronged attack, pushing, you know, trying to corner the Germans into one scenario, because the Germans knew they couldn't cross over the border into Botswana, because Botswana was also British territory. They couldn't go into the corner into what was, which we knew as Caprivi before the new name of Zambezi was applied. And that was a bit far, because obviously, you know, Caprivi was a little bit cut off. And this actually made things difficult for the Germans, because they needed to coordinate their retreats a lot better in terms of supplies, as well as also the ability to put up a defendable position against the advancing South Africans. Now, within 2 weeks, the German forces in the south were faced with certain destruction, and the governor at the time, his name is Sietz, surrendered at the town of Korup, which is north of Windhoek, which is actually closer to Otavi, you know. That being on 9 July 1915. Now, when the Germans provided lists of the names of the approximately 2,200 troops under their command, Botha told the German delegation that he had been tricked, as he knew that the Germans had 15,000 men. because the Germans stated there, and as I indicated to you, dear listeners, according to the reports, supposedly, the Germans were supposed to at least have 3,000 official soldiers, you know, trained soldiers, and 7,000 militia that consisted of settlers and, you know, like, partially trained people that could fight. Now, Viktor Franke, who was the German commander at the time, replied, "If we had 15,000 men, then you wouldn't be here and we wouldn't be in this position in the first place." I added the first place component, you know, after that. So which obviously illustrated to you in terms of, you know, how even the perceived intelligence at the time was also faulty, and the South Africans sort of like, well, to say that they overreacted is not an actual, you know, an actual observation to cite. Now, then there was also the fighting between the Germans and the Portuguese forces that advanced from Angola. Now, before an official declaration of war between Germany and Portugal actually came into effect, which was in March of 1916, and that's specifically in the German campaign in Angola, German and Portuguese troops fought several times on the border between German Southwest Africa and Portuguese Angola. Now, the Germans won most of these particular clashes and were able to occupy Humbe region in southern Angola until Portuguese control was restored a few days before the successful South African campaign defeated the Germans. Now, the German offensive into Angola spurred the native Awambo groups to revolt against the Portuguese rule. The ensuing Awambo uprising was not fully suppressed by the Portuguese and the British forces until after World War I. This particular chapter, in which was also part of Namibia's history, was an uprising actually against Portuguese colonial rule during World War I. And it lasted from about 18 December 1914 to 6 February 1917, with the death of, as I mentioned, King Mandume Ndemafayo by the South African forces in Namibia. So obviously, this particular chapter also saw a, you know, one of the first instances of various sort of like combat between the invading South Africans and obviously the Portuguese forces from Angola heading into that part of northern Namibia and ultimately the clashes that ensued. Now, the aftermath obviously from what then emanated from the engagement or from this particular chapter of World War I was that the South African casualties were 113. They had 113 that were killed, 153 that died of injury or illness, and 263 that were wounded. Of the overall 80,000, you know, combined Portuguese and South African contingent that invaded Namibia. The German casualties were just 103, with 890 that were taken prisoner, 37 field guns and 22 machine guns that were captured. And then there were obviously the collection of armaments that were thrown down into Lake Oshikota. That is a very interesting thing to know, because it's like six field guns that were thrown into Lake Oshikoto by the Germans after they surrendered, to the South Africans. And it's a very interesting part of history of Namibia, specifically during the First World War, that we were technically one of the battlefields, of the First World War chapter or the First World War indications, in the global scheme of things in terms of combat and so forth. The post-war scenario obviously saw that after the German colonial forces were defeated, South Africa obviously occupied the colony, because we were a colony, and then administered it as a League of Nations mandate territory from 1919. Now, just to let you guys know, from the Paris Peace Conference that was taking place, the South Africans expressly asked, from what was known, they expressly asked to take control of Namibia. They literally asked this. Jan Smuts or Louis Botha, one of the two, were present in, they were the guys that motivated that South Africa must be in control of said particular territory, which was us. Now, although the South African government they desired to incorporate Southwest Africa into the broader South African territory. They never officially did so, although it was administered as a de facto fifth province, with specifically the representation coming through from the Parliament of South Africa, as well as electing their own local administration in terms of a legislative assembly. Now, the South African government also appointed an administrator for Namibia, who had extensive powers, and when the League was superseded by the UN 1946, South Africa actually refused, as we all know now, to surrender its mandate as a trust territory. And the UN General Assembly then revoked it. In 1971, the ICJ issued an advisory opinion declaring South Africa's administration of Namibia to be illegal. Now, we'll be stepping into another musical break, dear listeners, and after that, we'll be coming into one of the interesting parts of the campaign itself, that obviously being the discussion, because I found a whole bunch of literature based upon many of these particular engagements between of the First World War chapter of the Southwest African campaign. And we'll be getting back into that right after this musical break.
Who draws the crowd and plays so loud? Maybe it's the guitar man. Gonna steal the show, you know, baby, it's the guitar man. He can make you love, he can make you cry. He will bring you down and he'll get you high. Something keeps him going miles and miles a day to find another place. Night after night to treat you right, baby, it's the guitar man. Who's on the radio? You go and listen to the guitar man. When he comes to town and you see his face, and you think you might like to take his place. Something keeps him drifting miles and miles away, searching for the songs to play. Then you listen to the music and you like to sing along. You want to get the meaning out of each and every song. Yourself a message and some words to call your own and take them home. And the sound is getting dim. The voice begins to falter and the crowds are getting thin. But he never seems to notice. He's just got to find another place to play. Yeah.
so long. When somebody heals, listen to the fear that's gone. Strangled by the wishes of daytime, open for the arms of nature. Get to me the sooner or later.
Coming back there from the sound specifically of Simply Red, and before that it was of Bread with the song of Guitar Man. Leaving us with about 15 minutes more still to go on this morning's particular session of my Sunday Morning Take. The interesting thing here, dear listeners, is specifically when you look at untold historical, not accounts, but events. Because guys, firstly, you know, when I went into this sort of like cultural tourism expedition itself, I was like, okay, you know, am I going to uncharted territory? What are we going to be looking at? And specifically, how would this, you know, play off? Now, in many cases, every day you forget that, you know, that there are correlations specifically between cultural history, tourism, cultural tourism, heritage tourism, heritage history, as well as also the aspect in terms of, you know, how all these things are gelled together in a broader context of giving a complete picture of Namibia's history. The reason why I put things like this is because you go to a country like America. America. I'm using America specifically. And even a country like South Africa. Where they will tell you, they will give you a 360 degree representation of the history. Whether it be from an indigenous perspective, whether it be from a colonial perspective, or a settler community perspective, you get that 360 degree picture and image in terms of how things came to be, as where you find the country today. I'll tell you now, dear listeners, in many cases, for example, you could go and look up, for example, one of the states in the states and cities in the United States, for example, the state of Illinois, which houses the city of Chicago. Now, go think to yourself, the name Chicago is not an English name. Probably it could, you know, you could perceive it as being French or Spanish in a way. But when you go look up, where does the name of the city of Chicago actually come from? Chicago itself, because you find the name Chicago, there's an Argentine football team with the same name, Chicago as well. And the importance of this particular thing, is that you realize that certain particular names, certain particular features, certain particular installations, certain particular events that you interact with today have a rich history of more than 100, 200 years itself in terms of understanding how did this thing come to be where we find ourselves. Now, I agree, for example, with the two governors, because I wrote the article of Friday's The Villager e-paper platform in terms of where the two governors of Oanguena region and of Ochotonjupa region believe that there's more to give the tourism market and economy of Namibia than just, you know, come and stay here at a lodge and that's it. Reason being why I say this is primarily when you look at the hospitality industry, in the tourism industry, is that the hospitality industry, which is a subset of the tourism economy, plays a specific function. They play a, yes, in some cases they can take on an aspect of giving you the tours, showing you the cultural and historic sites of a territory, but that they specifically play a hospitality role. Hospitality. On the other side, the community where you find, for example, that, let's call it a lodge or a bed and breakfast or a inn, where they find themselves, that community has to play the additional role in terms of bringing to light the historic events, the historic installations, the heritage sites, and so forth, and so forth, and so forth, and more, and so just from traversing specifically in terms of understanding the, for example, we went to Odibo. Odibo is the first, the settlement, the mission. The first mission, the first building there, that was constructed there. So the mission laid the foundation for a specific settlement to flourish from there. The same too also when we went to, we reached Nakambale itself. The mission building there itself, because now it's a whole tourist rest camp. That itself is also a heritage site. You go to Onanjokwe itself, the hospital itself, also a heritage site. So in many cases specifically, we've got so much historical installations in Namibia that can actively play a direct, particular, impactful role in terms of, oh wow, this is what Namibia houses, this is what Namibia owns, this is what Namibia has, this is the story that Namibia can tell. This story can become an economy. And this particular economic feature itself can be a highly diversified product that can be leveraged. That can be leveraged. Now, it brings us 9 minutes out from the top of the hour at 7 a.m., dear listeners. It's about, we still have like 9 minutes left. On that particular note, we'll be returning back to the musical, to the musical break. And on that note, dear listeners, at 7 a.m., we'll be saying our goodbyes. You can stay tuned for the rest of the programming that will follow on from 7 a.m., heading into the rest of your morning. That's obviously in your Sunday Sunday programming here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. But you're still in my company here on my Sunday Morning Take. And on that particular note, we'll be returning back to some mellow tracks and mellow tunes in terms of rounding out our program for this morning. Once again, returning back to, well, one of my fan favorites, who's always Jamiroquai, because he's actually from, I only realized recently that he's the genre that the, because if you guys don't know, Jamiroquai is actually a band. It's not the man. The lead singer is the guy that we always see, and we all think that his name is Jamiroquai. Jamiroquai is technically a band. You don't see the band, but nonetheless, we get back to some of these particular tracks, of their particular tracks, known as Feels Just Like It Should. We'll be coming back at 7 a.m., saying our goodbyes, and wishing you a wonderful Sunday from 7 a.m. onwards into the rest of your program, Sunday morning programming here with us.
Yeah. What a drag it is, the shape I'm in. Well, I go out somewhere, then I come home again. I light a cigarette, cause I can't get no sleep. There's nothing on the TV, nothing on the radio that means that much to me. On my life, watching America. On my life, panic in America. Yesterday was easy, happiness came and went. I got the movie script, but I don't know what it meant. I light a cigarette, cause I can't get no sleep. There's nothing on the TV, nothing on the radio that means that much to me. There's nothing on the TV, nothing on the radio that I can believe in. All my life, watching America. All my life, there's panic in America. Oh, 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 oh. There's trouble in America. Yesterday was easy as I got the news. Oh, when you get it straight, you stand up, you just can't lose. Give you my confidence, all my faith in life. Don't stand me up, don't let me down, no, I need you tonight. To hold me, say you'll be here.
Sure, you can get it right to a man in my condition. patience. She says, follow me, baby, though our tears have been cried. You and I can be forgiven for falling, for thinking that our hearts have both died. In this life we are still living. They step their thunder and they compare their scars, while their own foes scream out their name. And she says, we are all just children of the stars. Sweet boy, sweet girl, you are not to blame. No, no.
And that were the sounds specifically of Paolo Nutini with the song Children of the Stars. Before that, you heard Razor Wire with the song America. And obviously, it does bring us about 5 past the top of the hour of 7 a.m., 5 minutes past 7, just saying it like that. And obviously, welcoming you once again. If you've just woken up, if you've just gotten up, good morning, welcome. You're listening to your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. Obviously, my time is up, technically, in terms of, it already being 7 a.m. because my Sunday morning take ended 5 minutes back that way. But stay tuned, enjoy the rest of your programming in our company, and obviously we'll see each other during the course of the coming week, obviously on the home run, where it'll be myself and Helmut, obviously giving you the lowdown of various subject matter, talking points, and interesting topics that are happening in and around Namibia and the rest of the world. Stay tuned for the rest of your Sunday morning programming here in our company, and obviously enjoy the rest of your programming specifically with us, your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM, as we're obviously bringing you your Sunday or end of August programming to a close for the month of August. Obviously, July starts tomorrow. On that note, good morning, and let's see each other again, same time, same place, next week, or during the course of the week on the home run.